And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us, listening on WILL AM. And also, if you're watching online, we are webcasting today's program, so you can watch on our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. Either way, we're glad to have you with us. This morning, we'll have another conversation with a candidate who will be involved in Illinois' March primary. We are talking with candidates both for the State House and also for Congress. And the guest this morning is David Gill. He is one of two Democrats seeking their party spot on the ballot in a new district. This is the new 13th Congressional District. It stretches from Champaign-Urbana southwest all the way to the Mississippi River, and it includes the cities of Decatur, some of Bloomington, a good part of Springfield, and also a number of other cities, including places like Taylorville and Edwardsville. We're really pleased that Dr. Gill could be here and spend some time talking with us. We're trying to have a number of candidates on the show so that people who will be voting will have a chance to talk with them and ask them questions about the things that they think are most important. So this is your opportunity to do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, which we do have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and it's calls on us, 800-222-9455. We do also have email. So if you'd just like to write us, you can do that. And that's willtalk@illinois.edu. Our guest, David Gill, is a physician. He works as an emergency room doctor. He is a graduate of the University of Illinois Med School, right, here at Urbana-Champaign. And this would actually be his fourth run for Congress, the first time in this brand new district, but he has run for Congress before and has been on this program before. So welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate your having me on.
There are a number of things that I would like to try to ask you questions about, some really basic issues. But as a general way of starting, I think one of the things we know now is that approval ratings for Congress are pretty low. People are unhappy with what they see as gridlock. You would be, if elected, you would be a newcomer to Congress. It's possible you might, depending on what happens in the House, you might continue to be a member of the minority party. So as a freshman in Congress, coming into the situation where relations between the two parties are very tense, what could you see yourself doing to make Congress more productive?
Well, I think first it's important to recognize that I am not the favorite son of the Democratic Party. This has always been a relatively independent effort on my behalf and on the behalf of thousands of people around the country trying to install a citizen legislator in the U.S. House of Representatives. And it's become a more overt position, if you will, this time around with this contested primary, running against a young man who is smiled upon by the party at large, the power brokers in Washington, D.C., and, so I think that I certainly will have the freedom to reach across the aisle. And my goal is always to do good things for my fellow man and woman, and it always has been. It's not to satisfy party bosses or party elders. We don't get money from the party, never have. Thus I'm not told what to say or what position to take or what vote to cast. And so my ears are wide open. My hand is outstretched in friendliness to anybody there in Washington, whether it be Democrats, Republicans, or independents.
Mm. Well, could you give an example or two of some instance in which you would say that you really depart from the Democratic Party?
Certainly. I pride myself on the fact that I've taken a pledge to refuse all corporate PAC funding, and I refuse all funding from Wall Street bank PACs. That certainly doesn't endear me to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. The DCCC is funded by Goldman Sachs and Lockheed Martin and Bank of America and Pfizer and Merck and all the people that I would never take money from, because I think that the people in Congress, you know, they work for those who put them there. And my funding, we've raised almost $160,000 in this campaign, more than I raised in all of the 2010 general election. And every thin dime of that, every penny of that comes from ordinary men and women just like yourself.
Let me then just ask one other question. Then we have a caller here who's been waiting patiently, so I will not make them wait too much longer.
Okay.
If you were elected, how long would you see yourself serving?
You know, I espouse term limits. I think that, and I've listened for years to the downsides to term limits as well. But I think we must push back. Our democracy is being strangled, David, by career politicians, particularly the career politicians who are financed by the big corporations and Wall Street banks. And so I think one step toward pushing back against that loss of democracy is term limits for representatives and senators along the lines of the 1951 amendment that term limited presidents. And I'm not sure what the proper number is. I think 8 years is plenty. I won't disarm unilaterally. What I tell people is that I will work passionately on behalf of a constitutional amendment so that myself and all the representatives in Washington have to go away after X number of years and be replaced by new citizen legislators who bring new virtues and talents and skills to Washington.
All right. Well, we have a caller in Urbana. We will talk with them. They're our first. Line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Gill, I followed your campaign with interest, and I have two questions for you. Number one, what do you anticipate the crucial issues will be that will be facing this Congress, and how does your particular background equip you to deal with these issues? And the second is a little more personal. I have family members serving in the military. With what's happening in the Middle East, with so many returning from war with all of their needs, and the current downsizing of our military, if you're elected, what kind of representation can our military veterans and military families expect from you? And I'll get off and listen, and I thank you very much for taking my call.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Good questions. I think that the highest priority of anybody going to Washington right now has to be restoring the health of our economy. And I think that, again, that this is a byproduct, this economy in which so many people, you know, the 99% or the 99.8 or the 98, so many Americans have been struggling for a decade, and for many people, four decades, is a manifestation of a Congress, Democrats and Republicans, which has been owned by the large multinational corporations and the Wall Street banks. And we need to push back against that. We need to restore our economy. We can do that through cutting the deficit, which ought to be done through raising revenues and cutting spending. That's another area, David, where I can certainly work with people from all sides, you know, both sides of the aisle. By growing a healthy economy, you grow jobs. I've talked for years about reforming our healthcare system. When you engage in appropriate reform of healthcare, you shower the economy with money that currently is being thrown into a black hole. And there's the National Nurses Union estimates 3 million new jobs on day one when you have appropriate health care reform in this country. Going forward with the Green Revolution is talked about so often by politicians, but there seems to be inaction and stagnancy with respect to that. But pushing forward with that, again, means millions of more jobs. And so I think the whole idea of restoring the economy through good deeds in other areas like healthcare and health of the planet would be my primary focus. With respect to veterans, I think that veterans need somebody in Washington who understands that, first of all, we should only be using our servicemen and women putting their lives on the line when absolutely necessary. Again, something that's trumpeted and parroted by politicians and would-be politicians, but something that's very meaningful to me. Back, I started running initially for Congress in December 2002, prior to the 2004 election. And so we had not yet invaded Iraq at the time. And Mr. Johnson, my ostensible opponent in the general, he shook his fist at me at the time when I was saying we ought not to invade Iraq. That's not a reason to put our young men and women's lives on the line. He shook his fist at me and called me unpatriotic. And I think that we should show enough respect for those young men and women that we only place them in harm's way when absolutely necessary. I think, too, that having the perspective that I have as a healthcare provider, I've spent plenty of time in VA facilities. I see plenty of veterans in my work as an emergency department physician and understand some of the issues which these young men and women bring back home from Iraq and Afghanistan, in particular some of the mental health issues. And it's important that those be given the same level of importance and emphasis as a missing limb, per se. And we need to be sure that there's appropriate funding available. I've spoken out against Mr. Johnson numerous times for a vote that he cast in 2010, in which he said we don't even have enough money to fund our veterans' health care system anymore. He was outvoted, fortunately, 411-6. But that has to be amongst our highest priorities. I have the utmost respect for the young men and women who, and middle-aged men and women for that matter, who are serving in the military. And we should do everything possible to make sure that they have access to appropriate housing, jobs, education. And these are people that have made very, very special sacrifices on behalf of all of the rest of us.
We have another caller. Again, I want to make sure that the caller knows I will not make them wait forever. But I would like to follow up just a little bit on a couple of the things that you said. When you said that we need to stimulate the economy and we need to cut the deficit. And then there are a couple of things, specific things that you said, raising revenues, cutting spending. Okay. So let me just maybe we'll save spending and then we'll get onto the caller. But let me ask you about revenues, raising revenues. How do you do that?
It's something that it doesn't take anybody with a degree in math. I have a degree in math, but I don't need that. You look back to a relatively great Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, in the 1950s. The top marginal tax rate at that time, David, was 91%. And I'm not proposing that we return to that, but we've watched decade after decade, we've watched that turn down to 70 and then 50 and then 39 and then 35. We've watched Tim Johnson vote for those tax cuts in 01 and 03 that took it down to 35. We've watched him vote to cut the taxes virtually in half on capital gains and dividends, another thing that impacts the wealthiest in this country. The gains in income because of that capital gains tax being cut almost in half almost universally went to the wealthiest in our society. And I've long said, why should somebody pay twice as much in taxes because they sweat for their work as someone else who simply goes and opens their mailbox and gets a check out of the mailbox? So there's untold trillions, perhaps. I was going to say billions, but really trillions of revenue that's been left on the table and that we've all had to make up for because of this constant turning down of the top marginal tax rate over more than a half century. So lots of revenues to be raised.
So you would think that tax rates should be increased?
Certainly on the millionaires and billionaires, those who have had things pushed in their favor for the better part of 40 years. I have no problem at all with that. I think the corporations too. President Obama talks about economic justice, and I think he's serious when he talks about raising the rates on millionaires and billionaires. And that's one reason why I would like to be part of a push to have a majority in the U.S. House. The corporations, GE, pays zero taxes. There's untold numbers of corporations that pay actually negative taxes. They get more back in subsidies than they put forth in taxes. They have these guys in Washington, D.C., these congresspeople writing a tax code that's 27,000 pages in length just to fill, to make sure that everybody's got their little loophole in there. And it's not right because ultimately all the rest of us who are playing by the rules and kicking in our tax money about this time of year have to make up the difference. And ultimately, as we've seen over the last decade, eventually you can't make up the difference. Eventually it gets pushed so far that we all go tumbling over the cliff.
Let me take a moment here to introduce again the guest, David Gill. He is one of two Democrats seeking their party spot on the ballot in the new 13th Congressional District. And they will be competing in the Illinois March primary that takes place 2 weeks from today.
Yep, right? 14
yeah,
days.
From today. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have another caller, Champaign County. Their next line, number one, right here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Just on this subject, I don't take Obama's language on this, and I think you can differentiate yourself from the leaders of the Democratic Party by saying that the Warren Buffett rule, or whatever they're calling this tax reform, that he should his secretary should pay he should pay the same rate as the secretary, is wrong. I mean, he should pay a higher marginal rate, and that's a way of differentiating yourself. And I think it's an important one, too. You alluded to the rates, marginal rates, as it goes up the income scale. That isn't a hard thing. That people are saying flat taxes are more simple than that. It's not that hard for people to calculate that out. But anyway, what I was really motivated to call was I was also wondering why you didn't differentiate yourself immediately by saying you were a single-payer advocate, which is one of the most important things we could do to get healthcare expenditures in line with what percentage the rest of the world spends on healthcare and gets better outcomes, is to, you know, get rid of this the idea that insurance, you know, who make money by playing with your money while they're deferring your payments, basically. That's the worst possible solution to financing healthcare, it seems to me. And I don't think I'll get an argument out of you, but I think that's something to emphasize. Vis-a-vis, I've already had the argument with you on a prior occasion about this term limit business. If we get the money out of politics and reform the way political money goes into campaigns, we won't have to worry about term limits or anything like that. What term limits would do now is they would just increase the speed of the revolving door that where representatives go in and be lobbyists. And I think making a pledge to never be a lobbyist after a political career would be an admirable thing to advocate. So I'd like for some reactions on that score.
All right. Sure. Thanks.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I would say better than a pledge would be to work toward legislation, making it illegal on a lifetime basis to go on to be a lobbyist after putting in time as a representative in Washington, D.C. I couldn't agree more with you. Yeah, I mean, I could probably speak for 20 minutes with regards to how I differ from the Washington, D.C. Democratic Party in general. But you're right. My passionate advocacy of a single-payer healthcare financing system certainly sets me apart. They wouldn't even allow the single-payer advocates any of the 44 seats at the table when they initially started their so-called healthcare reform. And I agree with you also with respect to Warren Buffett. Yeah, I'm a believer in progressive taxes, and certainly Mr. Buffett bringing in 9 figures per year can afford to pay a higher tax rate than his secretary can. And so I agree with you on all of that. You also mentioned insurance companies deferring payment while they're playing with your money. So in so many cases that I've seen in my 29 years in healthcare, it's ultimately not just simply not paying on your behalf rather than paying on a tardy, delayed basis. So it sounds like you and I are on the same page on many, many issues. And you're right. There's many ways in which I differ from this party. And again, that's been borne out more clearly over these last several weeks, watching who they've chosen to run against me in a contested primary.
One other tax question. We tax, for people who live off their investments, we tax that differently than people who are paid a wage.
Right.
Should we change that?
Yes. That was my point. If someone goes out to sweat for a living, stocking shelves at Kmart as I did when I was in college here, or mopping the floors of a laundromat like I did when I was in medical school here, I don't think that tax rate should be twice the rate of simply using an envelope opener to take your check out of an envelope. So, yeah, the fact that those are taxed differently, it boggles my mind and the minds of many, many people that I meet on the campaign trail.
Okay, let's take another caller. Urbana, this is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask Dr. Gill, because of your unique perspective as a physician, your assessment of the Obama healthcare plan. Specifically, what do you see as strong progressive advantages to what's being proposed and at least gradually being implemented, and where it doesn't go far enough in terms of healthcare provisions and financing it and whatever issues in there you would care to address?
Well, thanks. I appreciate the question. The Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act, that was passed, I think falls woefully short of what we need in this country. It's not anywhere near what we need with respect to health care reform. At the end of the day, The biggest fact about it is that it delivers 32 million more customers into the clutches of a private health insurance industry that doesn't exist for your health or my health. If you look at their mission statements, their primary mission amongst the private health insurance industry is to maximize shareholder return. And so the healthcare reform as passed, the Affordable Care Act, didn't include a public option, sadly. It was written by people that just came over, lobbyists that just came over from WellPoint to Max Baucus's office. There's a revolving door there. And Max Baucus gets $4 million from WellPoint, which is one of the five big private health insurers in this country. And he writes the bill, and they shut out single payer, and there's no public option. And there are some good things about it. All that said, there are some good things. One, and sort of fundamentally, is that you had official Washington stand up and finally, after all these decades, say the status quo is not good. I can't tell you how many times I've listened to Mr. Johnson travel old Illinois 15 saying, we have the best health care in the world. Well, having lived in it since 1983, I'm very, very aware that we have nowhere near the best health care in the world. Sad to say. You know, it's a shame because we put so much money into it, but it's, you know, it's not anywhere near the best. And Washington finally said, it needs help. And so they took some measures to try to help it. A couple of good things in there. They left out, they can no longer turn you away for a pre-existing condition. You're allowed to keep your child on till age 26. Wendell Potter, who is a whistleblower now, he was a VP at Aetna, I believe, or Cigna, forgive me. He travels the country now talking about the inner workings of these health insurance firms and how they continue to squeeze and maximize profit no matter what obstacles get thrown in their way. He talks about how the inability to exclude people for pre-existing conditions, they have factored that in, and they will be driving up premiums to take that into account as well. And so it's nowhere near good enough. The John Roberts Supreme Court certainly has yet to take its actions with respect to the mandate that citizens purchase this shoddy product. And I'm looking, there's still healthcare. We're not done with it. We're not anywhere close, because we need healthcare reform not only to be far healthier, but also to be far wealthier. This country will be so much better off economically, as I alluded to originally, with respect to restoring our economy, when we stop playing at this incredible disadvantage relative to the rest of the world, who all of whom have national health care plans.
Let me just ask you about one of the implications of this that I think has people in state government very concerned, and that is that a significant number of people now who don't have health insurance are going to end up going on to the Medicaid rolls. Already the state's Medicaid spending is way out of control, and in Springfield what they're saying is, oh, well, we've got to do something about this. And they're talking about things like either cutting services, cutting back on people who get benefits, or cutting, well, one of the things on the table is cutting payments to providers, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, although that's something that the legislature has in the past said, no, we don't want to do. I'm not sure that that's going to happen. But how would you feel about a system that would do that, that would suddenly increase the burden that, the state of Illinois and its budget has to deal with, because there are going to be people who are coming into Medicaid?
You're speaking my language, David. It's that's another statement with regards to why this Affordable Care Act ultimately is a failure. And like so much that Washington does, you know, the rubber meets the road, so to speak, at city government and, you know, at the smaller levels of government. And poor old state government in so many arenas, not just healthcare, has been suffering and struggling because Washington fails to be responsible. And this is another case of Washington being irresponsible and passing on these terrible decisions, these Sophie's choices, if you will, for people like Mike Frerichs and Naomi Jacobson to make, and choices that just simply can't be made. I mean, there's no good option. They're all bad options, and because this isn't real reform, what's been put forth. And, eventually we'll, I'm always saying pretty soon we'll get around to real reform. Well, I intend to be very vocal about it when I get to Washington, D.C., and there's some people that said to me after this thing got passed in early 2010, well, you've talked about healthcare for years and years, and they're all done now with that. And sadly, very sadly, we're not even close to done.
Right. Let's take some of the calls. Line one, Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard something at one point in time, and I'm kind of curious whether this would ever be revisited. And it was that states must maintain balanced budgets, and whether that means that they have to cut services or they have to take out of one pile and put it into another to make things work, or just have huge piles of back pay debts. And now we have some of the largest debt in the union. I mean, there's our pensions out of is out of control, and we're not making our budgets. At one point in time, I'd heard that there was a possibility to maybe say, is it possible to for a state to declare bankruptcy, rebalance its debts, and then just be able to move forward? especially, I mean, if you look worldwide, there are countries that essentially just break down and just restructure and just bite the bullet and start over. Would that be something that would be something you would support or consider or look into? My main reason is just that you know, almost daily you can look at what's going on in Illinois and companies leave or solutions like trying to increase tax base drives people away. And I kind of like Illinois. I've lived here most of my life, and just to see it in the state that it is, I wouldn't mind just eventually break down, declare bankruptcy, rebalance, and somehow start over. I mean, there seems like there has to be a solution that's unfortunately probably going to have to be dramatic. I'm just curious if you'd comment on that.
Sure, and yeah, I don't mean to be facetious here when I say that a lot of people tell me, you're crazy to run for Congress, you know, for a federal seat. And I say, yeah, but I'm not as crazy as I would be if I was running for the State House, because I agree with you, caller. The poor old state of Illinois is just in a very, very dire situation. You mentioned the requirement to balance budgets. I believe that varies state to state, that it can be written into their state constitution that they must balance their budgets. And I kid you not, I feel like I have lots of answers for some of the problems that face us at the federal level, and I don't know that I have good solutions for the things that ail us at the state level. I think that ultimately I'm a believer that, as I alluded to in the previous question, that some of the problems within the state can only be helped by having a strong federal government that's healthy in a fiscal and economic sense. And you know, it doesn't matter. I mentioned Mike Ferricks and Naomi Jacobs, and I feel terrible for Republicans in Springfield as well. You know, Chapin Rose and people, Jason Barrickman and Shane Coulter, they all have a terrible road to hoe with the state that our state is in. Poor Governor Quinn. And, you know, I think it's all a manifestation of stuff that has gone on for years and years. And again, I don't know that I can specifically speak to that. I'm not running for that. I also don't pretend to have any expertise with regards to the implications of a state declaring bankruptcy. I think it wouldn't be pretty. I think that your credit rating would obviously be, you know, in the basement, so to speak, mm-hmm. and your recovery from that would be difficult. I think federally, you know, we hear a lot of talk and steam blown off with regards to the deficit these days. I think it's important to realize this is something that has occurred over just over a decade, you know, that Bill Clinton left office with the U.S. at its healthiest surplus in American history. And it was this is just simple arithmetic or data or facts. But, you know, 70-80% of the deficit was created during Mr. Johnson's first 8 years in Washington, D.C., as he and his ilk supported the tax cuts for the wealthiest, the Medicare prescription drug bill, where they wrote in that they would refuse to negotiate on price with the drug companies, and as well as the wars that Mr. Johnson was behind. So it's correctable. The current federal deficit is correctable, and we can get back on track. I think when we talk about that, we need to talk about the trade deficit as well. And I think that part and parcel of repairing our economic health is restoring some balance within trade in this country.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with David Gill. He is a candidate for Congress in the new 13th Congressional District, one of two Democrats seeking their party spot on the ballot in the primary that will happen in 2 weeks. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, presenting American Spirit on Saturday, March 10th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. Sinfonia celebrates the originality and innovation of American composers from Gillis to Gershwin. Jim Pugh, Jonathan Keeble, and Dmitry Kuzov are featured. More information is available at 333-6280.
And this is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. On the program tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk with award-winning poet Sandra Beasley, who's someone who has lived with severe allergy issues throughout her life. And she's written a memoir that we'll be talking about. The title of her book is Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life. That's tomorrow. Then on Thursday, we will talk about the increasing number of people who have made the decision to live alone. And our guest there will be Eric Kleinenberg. He is a professor of sociology at New York University, and he's the author of a book on this that's just recently come out. The title of his book is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. That is the subtitle. And then let me tell you one more. Tim Johnson will be our guest on the program on Thursday, and this will be in the 11 o'clock hour. So he's another of the candidates that we're having on this program to give you some access to them. And I do also want to mention that Dr. Gill's opponent, Matt Getten, will also be on this program. He'll be a guest here on March 14th in the 11 o'clock hour. So you'll have the opportunity to hear from him. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions, comments. You can get the schedule by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. We're broadcasting this morning on WILL Radio. We're also webcasting through the website, so you can see us if you like. Just go to will.illinois.edu. One more thing I want to mention. At noon today, we'll have live coverage of a press conference by the president, President Obama, and he is most likely, we expect, will be talking about the Middle East. And Jennifer Ludden, NPR, will be co-anchoring and giving some analysis. So that's an NPR News special, presidential news conference, live today at noon here on WILL AM. And in this hour of the show, we're talking with David Gill. He is one of two Democrats seeking their party spot on the ballot in the new 13th Congressional District. The primary takes place in 2 weeks. Questions are certainly welcome, and we have several. We'll try to get in as many people as we can. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. That's will-talk at illinois.edu. Let us go back to the phones and talk again with somebody in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I would like to hear Dr. Gill tell about how he and his primary opponent differ. I think that's important to know.
All right.
That's a tough question. I'm running against a gentleman who...
Oof. That's okay.
Who it's been difficult to get him to define himself or to understand why he's in this race. This is a man who I listened in late October. I went to visit the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in late October in Washington, D.C., and I told them my views with regards to corporate funding of politics and government, and I left there. I don't think either of us were very happy with each other, and a couple of days later, I saw this young man here in Champaign. He addressed a crowd of about 200 people and said he was not running for this office and in fact was working on my behalf in the western part of the district. And it was 2 or 3 days after that I went to Madison County and discovered, and he told me he'd come under some pressure and had changed his mind and he was running. And it's not clear to me why he's running, what he has a passion for. I waited 90 days on his website to learn more about him and what he believes in. And his website for 90 days said, come back soon because there'll, you know, in the coming days and weeks, we'll expand our views on things. After about 85 or 90 days, he did expand it to where I still have a difficult time knowing exactly where he stands on the issues of the day. And so to answer the caller's question is somewhat difficult. I know that I am someone who for years and years has been a 100% pro-choice candidate when it comes to women's bodies and reproductive freedoms. I think that these are decisions that should be left to the female citizens of this country. I've delivered hundreds of babies, and I've borne witness to dozens of miscarriages in the emergency department setting, and so I know lots and lots about reproduction, more so than a lot of these politicians and would-be politicians, and I'm firmly convinced that these are women's matters that should be dealt with without the involvement of individuals like Timothy Johnson. And my opponent, on the other hand, when it comes to reproductive rights, has repeatedly issued a statement in which he states, I'm a pro-choice Catholic who always chooses life. And I don't know what that's supposed to mean. I think that it's, he's been a politician for 8 years, and perhaps he's mastered that art of talking out of both sides of his mouth. So he and I seem to differ on that. We also differ with respect to, I mentioned earlier that I've taken a pledge to refuse the funding of the corporations and the Wall Street banks. And my opponent, I issued a challenge to all of my opponents in this race, Democrat and Republican alike, to join me in that pledge. And we've been met with silence to this point over 4-5 months. I've also signed a pledge down in Edwardsville at the public library there. He wasn't at this event. It was an event to a group of citizens that are working. There's many groups around the country working to overturn the impact of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which opened the floodgates for the corporate takeover of our politics and our government. And I signed a pledge that evening promising the voters that when I get to Washington, D.C., I will work avidly toward a constitutional amendment that declares that corporations are not people and that money is not speech. And my opponent has not signed that pledge. So those are ways that jump to mind. And he's had his life to live. And far be it from me, he's a pleasant man. I've met him several times in person. He's a charming young man. Since December 2002, I've been speaking out on the issues of the day, putting myself out there on the line as a standard bearer for this party, running in a district that frankly was the most Republican district in this state, and constantly beating the point spread, losing by 15, 20, 22 instead of the 40 that one is supposed to lose by. And I haven't seen him out doing that. We do differ as well in that I don't have friends or family in high places. He is the son of a good friend of Senator Dick Durbin. So that's another way of differentiating us.
Just this also would be a good opportunity for me to mention that the two candidates will be in our studios, our television studios, on March 14th, Wednesday, for a debate. This is a live program in partnership with the Illinois League of Women Voters, and it will be broadcast live beginning at 7 o'clock on WILL-TV and a number of other television stations, public television stations. Will also be simulcast on WILL-AM. Both audio and video will be streamed on our website. So the two candidates, you'll have the opportunity to see the two of them side by side. And they will be answering questions from a panel of journalists. And again, that's live on WILL-TV on Wednesday, March 14th, 7 o'clock in the evening.
David, that's another way in which we differ. We offered Matthew Gettin 6, 8, 10 similar debates around the district so that voters could get a sense of who we are and what we stand for. And he refused to engage in those candidate forums.
All right.
Other than the one that you guys are kind enough to host.
All right. Well, let us continue. And we'll talk with another person here. This is somebody, I believe, in Urbana, line number 2. Hello. Is there a caller there in Urbana, line 2? All right. How about we try our line 3? Someone on a cell phone, I think. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Good morning, David and Dr. Gill. I'm going to pull you back to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act again. I wanted to follow up on the discussion on how, with the new healthcare, how the number we increase in the Medicaid and the states are struggling to pay for it. But it was my understanding, though, that for any new patient who is added to the Medicaid, the federal government will pay for it.
Can you repeat that?
Is that true? He's saying that it was his understanding that if someone ends up being added onto the Medicaid rolls in the state of Illinois, that the state of Illinois wouldn't have to be bearing the burden of that additional expense, that government, that the federal government would it would pay money to the state, and then that would help cover that person.
Well, yes. And hopefully that'll be how it plays out, but I think the proof is in the pudding. I think those of us who have been engaged in healthcare for so long and have seen the way that public aid, Medicaid, has been managed and financed or mismanaged and malfinanced have little faith. Not to mention, beyond the financing of it, is the fact that it continues to be very difficult for patients who are on Medicaid to find providers to do anything other than to go to that most expensive healthcare venue in the world, the American Emergency Department. And so we continue to be overrun more and more month by month in the emergency department setting by Medicaid recipients because the healthcare providers increasingly refuse to see them because of the relatively poor payment that the doctors and nurse practitioners receive. So I think it's good to be hopeful, but again, I say fix it in the right way, and then we won't have to just rely on hopes and wishes.
Yeah, and really the act also is not perfect in any shape or form, but I feel like it's better than what we have right now. But you as a physician, as a provider of patient care, I kind of wondered how can you compare what we have in the reform and what we have now? Is that going to be, because I hear some people argue that physicians are not happy about the reform, and some of them are advocating for, completely repeal. Some of them are saying amendment. I wonder what your view is on that.
Sure. I would say, first of all, that many, many physicians, like many, many Americans, don't have a good understanding of really of what was in that very lengthy bill. And so I would take with a grain of salt what's being said by individual physicians or groups of physicians. I do know that upwards of 60% of American physicians would like to see a single-payer healthcare system or improved Medicare for all. And I do know, having been in healthcare so long, I know that if you put enough physicians in a room that eventually you'll hear grumbling of some sort or another with regards to about anything. And so I don't put much stock in any individual comments by physicians. And to be perfectly honest, I think many people are taking a wait-and-see approach with regards to what it is that has passed because like I say, the implementation remains to be seen, and I think we'll see how people respond. I personally am of the opinion that the apple cart is going to be upset, whether completely or in pieces by the Supreme Court later on this year remains to be seen. But it's almost beside the point what we think about healthcare reform as it is colored today, because change is coming through that Supreme Court, I suspect.
I want to thank the caller. I have somebody else. We'll try to get some other folks in the time that remains, and we have about 7-8 minutes. I want to come back to something way back at the beginning of the program. You talked about the issue of the budget and mm-hmm. raising revenue and cutting spending. I at least want to pose the question about spending.
Mm-hmm.
If you could be as specific as you could about places that you think in the federal budget there should be cuts.
Certainly two places leap out. One would be the billions, if not tens of billions, some years, of dollars that we subsidize the oil industry with. That's on top of the record profits that they're making on top of us as we go pump our automobiles full of $4 per gallon gasoline. Why we're doing that is, I haven't met anybody yet, Republican or Democrat, who understands why we're spending that kind of money out of our budget. Secondly, our defense budget has tripled since the late 1990s. Over the last 13 or 14 years, it has tripled. It's very, very bloated. It's filled with fat. And that's separate and apart from the wartime costs, the costs associated with war. That can surely be pared back substantially without making us any less safe here in central Illinois. So I think those are two prime places to begin to reduce spending. I think that's an issue that Mr. Johnson now agrees with me on. He talks all the time about reducing spending on defense, and he talks about now, after the fact, about getting us out of our involvement in these wars overseas.
What do you think now about the concerns regarding Iran and its nuclear program and whether or not there should be military action against them?
David, you had to ask that. I travel around saying that's the one unanswerable. State finances are unanswerable. Mm. Iran is unanswerable. I mean, I read about Iran, and I talk to experts in foreign policy, and there's not a good answer. I think that we should. President Obama gave a pretty good talk to the AIPAC on Sunday. I agree with a lot of what the president had to say. It's certainly something that needs to be taken very seriously. I think Americans are rightfully cynical after, you know, being led into Iraq over what wound up not being much of anything. If I had the answer, you know, I think they'd be talking about a Nobel Peace Prize.
Well,
I think the important point is take it seriously, recognize Ahmadinejad and frankly, the mullahs propping up Ahmadinejad represent a true threat to that region and ultimately to America, and recognize the ramifications of war there. It's the most, for me, it is the most difficult situation that there is with respect to foreign federal matters.
Well, if it could be established either that Iran had a nuclear bomb or was on the threshold of having one, would you support military action against them to prevent that from going any further?
I'd want to see very definitive evidence with regards to that, and I would want to have seen that every step prior to warfare had been taken by the UN and the Arab League and so on and so forth. But ultimately, I think that for the Iranians to have nuclear-tipped warheads is likely more dangerous than some intervention prior to it coming to that.
All right. Let's take another call. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I heard Romney say that we should get rid of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And I've heard on several occasions that Congress, the government, borrowed $13 trillion from the Social Security Trust, and I think it was in the 1980s. And it seems that everybody has forgotten all about that. So when you forget about $13 trillion and you still haven't paid it back, I would say that's stealing.
Well, I appreciate the question. Let me just ask in a direct way, say Social Security. Do you think that any changes should be made to the system as it's structured?
Certainly. I talk all the time about the need to raise that ceiling on taxation with respect to Social Security. People that are making more than $110,000 a year are paying a lower tax rate with regards to their Social Security taxes. There's a ceiling put on. When you get to $110,001, that final dollar is not taxed at all. So if you're making $220,000 a year, you're being taxed at half the rate of the people making $0 to $110,000 per year. And I think that ceiling needs to be raised substantially, if not done away with altogether. Social Security could be so healthy, in the course of a day, if that ceiling was dealt with in a very matter of fact manner. So that's the change that I would engage in.
And what about the issue of raiding the trust and taking money out of that?
Yeah, you know, Al Gore talked about this in the 2000 presidential campaign. You know, the lockbox, and that's how it should be. And I think the failure to keep it separate and apart from the rest of the general revenues is a terrible mistake to let these guys in Washington dip their hands in it and throw it at pork is a mistake.
What about Medicaid? I would think that your ultimate goal would be it to have a national healthcare system, and so that would cover everybody.
Right.
But short of that, because the Medicaid costs are a serious burden both on the state of Illinois but both on the federal government. Are there some ways in which you think that program could be changed or restructured to save money?
Well, I think that we could start by, you know, and again, you asked originally about reaching out to all sides and getting around the bickering. And I think that we at least ought to be extending Medicare downward, you know, or allow Medicare not, don't wait till you're 65 to be in Medicare. How about Medicare for age 0 to 18 and ages 55 and above? You know, and there was a lot of talk of compromise like that as healthcare reform was being pushed forward through 09 and 2010. And I think that we should take steps like that, and we could get around the difficulties with Medicaid if we would push forward in those ways federally. So, you know, we might not get to Medicare for all overnight, but if you want to do it incrementally, you know, involving the 55-year-olds and then 3 to 5 years later involving the 45-year-olds and, you know, and bringing early on the children who really don't cost much, you know, relatively in large numbers, children don't eat up a lot of health care dollars. Mm-hmm.
We're coming to the point where we maybe only have about a minute left. There, we've talked about a number of things. Let me just try to ask you a quick question about agricultural policy, since there are a lot of farmers in the 13th. Anything in particular that you would want to do to address their needs?
I think that, you know, farming is very, very difficult business, and they face risks that many of the rest of us don't face. And I think that they need appropriate insurance, if you will, from the federal government with regards to subsidies based on need. And as it is today, it tends to be subsidies based on size. And I think that if they have a bad year, you know, if crops fail to grow because of drought or flooding or what have you, that that there's a role for us to prop them up in some manner. And but the way that it's been fashioned for the last several years over the past couple of farm bills, I think results in some injustices that many of us, again, are putting forth needless dollars for those who are already doing very well.
Mm. Well, we're going to have to stop at this point because All right. We're here at the end of the time. Our guest is David Gill. He is one of two Democrats seeking their party spot on the ballot in the new 13th Congressional District. His opponent, Matt Gatton, will be here on this program on March 14th. And also, I do want to mention once again that the two candidates will be here for a live debate in our studios on Wednesday, March 14th. This is something that is being done in sponsorship with the Illinois League of Women Voters. So you can see that live on WILL-TV at 7, Wednesday, March 14th. It'll also be simulcast both audio and video on our website and will be simulcast on WILL-AM. And thank you very much for being here.
It's been my pleasure, David. Thank you again.